Welcome to the Intersectionality Lab, a fair space to explore intersections.
Welcome, my name is Inga and my pronouns are she, her. And in today's episode, we want to highlight the important work of Queer Swit, which is an NGO and is supporting lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans and queer people, as well as people of color and indigenous people in the area of the Ukraine, Russia, Belarus and the larger Eastern Europe and Central Asian countries. For decades, LGBTQ plus people and people of color have been affected by war and or political persecution in this country. And Queer Swit is a Black queer-run independent team of volunteers all over the world. And they are aiming for safety by providing consultations, purchasing tickets, finding free accommodation and providing humanitarian aid. So today we welcome Anna Maria. You are the co-founder of Queer Swit and the CEO. So welcome and thank you very much for joining. Maybe you can give a small introduction to yourself and also tell us a little bit about Queer Swit and how was it founded and how it developed since then.
Thank you for having me. I'm really thankful to be here. So my name is Anna Maria Desfaye. I'm Ethiopian and Russian. So my mom is Russian and my father is Ethiopian. I was born and raised in Russia, and my dad was present, I'm highlighting this because a lot of people of African descent in Russia grow up without their parent who is African, so they don't really know much about racism. I think I really felt and understood the problem, and I felt that it's the problem in people, not in me, since I was pretty young. I can't even say when I became an anti-racist activist. So I'm an anti-racism activist as well as I'm a queer activist. I'm also a documentary filmmaker and I used to work in entertainment TV. So I'm trying to combine all of this and imply it in my life and Queer Swit, of course. So we founded Queer Swit during the protest, which was on the, I don't remember what day was the protest, but probably the 2nd of March. It was here in London when the war escalation started. And we were there, me, my wife, who is also, she's Russian Senegalese. And it is actually, I think, quite a coincidence but that we found each other in general. And as well as one of our friends who is a gay refugee from Ukraine and another one who is a trans woman of Ukrainian descent. And basically we just thought that we should do something. And when we started that, when we started Queer Swit, we thought that we are going to be basically people are going to come to us and we will tell them where to go because there's not a lot of information, especially because first of all, of course, we want to help Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard to find out where you can go, in which country, what kind of support you may get, especially when you're in a huge amount of stress. So we started like this and then it became a very big thing. Actually, I am the only founder who is still here, and not because we had any kind of fight or argument, just because no one expected it to be a full-time job, which is understandable, which on the other hand actually puts me in a kind of weird position because I am still from, I have a Russian descent and I have a Russian passport, but our organization's name is Ukrainian and some people don't like it. And for me, this is still something that I don't know what to do because a Ukrainian person named it and still remains the founder, just not involved in the work. And I decided that for us, it's going, because we in general, we want to expand and become an organization that just helps queer people and people of color affected by war wherever and dictatorship wherever, because there are not a lot of organizations actually that help with queer migration. And it's only just starting, because most organizations are saying, okay, yes, we are in a safe country, for example, the UK. When you come to the UK, we will help you. But they are not, I'm not saying financially help, because even us, we don't have a lot of grants. Mostly we live off fundraising. So of course, we do have some money, but we usually help someone who is in an emergency financially. But even to talk to a person and come up with a case on where to go, how to get there, what opportunities are there, is already important. And I personally believe, as a person who is queer and Black, that queer people and people of color, global majority, they are two of the most marginalized groups, and they usually take the suffering, if not first, well, then second. So, for example, in Russia now, we can see that they started passing a lot of anti-queer laws, as well as mobilizing to war, mostly people from non-Slavic regions. And I think this is because no one but people of these groups cares about these people. So it's really easy. And now they're talking about abortion, for example. So step by step, and unfortunately, this is the time that you don't want to say, I told you so, but I actually thought so. And this is why we founded Queersfeed, actually, because we thought that, thankfully, in Ukraine, though, sorry, probably you didn't expect for such a long answer. There's just one thing which is really warms my heart, is that because Russia is so queerphobic and homophobic, people in Ukraine obviously feel a lot of negative feelings towards Russia, and they level of homophobia and queerphobia in general in Ukraine, according to queer organizations that work there, is decreasing, which is good news, even though there are still problems with, for example, especially students and people from Africa, South Asia, basically everyone who doesn't have European passport and lives in Ukraine. There are still quite a lot of problems with getting out of the country, but that's another story. So yeah.
Maybe we can come back to this intersection of characteristics or features or identities later a bit. But first, because you already mentioned the current situation, like last week, I think on the 30th of November, right? The Russian Supreme Court ruled that the international LGBTQ plus movement as an extremist organization, I'm putting this in quotes because it's obviously not, but they claim it. And so far, or how does this decision affect your work, or what is the situation right now?
Well, of course, we have much more requests from Russia, which are mostly from people who want to run away ASAP. However, we still do not know what this means. And I don't, because recently, before this, it was easier to evaluate the risks of a person, because if someone who doesn't do any activism and who, for example, if it's a cisgendered person who has a job, who is, as people say, straight passing, it doesn't mean that they, if they want to leave, obviously we will help them, but we'll help them in a way that we will create a plan together on where and how this person can leave, but we're not in a hurry. Now, I don't, for example, there is in Russia, there is another app like Grindr, but it's called Hornet. It's kind of the same thing, even though I'm still kind of confused on how to use it because I'm not the target audience. But I don't know if, for example, the police stops a person and sees this app, would they be considered as extremists? No one knows. And we have a lot of requests, and obviously we cannot do much about some of them that are still on lower risk, except for advice them stuff on how to behave in Russia, for example, like how to maybe, like, for example, put a lot of passwords, like don't have the face ID when they stop you, stuff like that. But still, a lot of people are panicking and they feel like no one can help us because you're just giving me advice. But to be honest, even the lawyers, they do not know what it means yet. So it's really confusing. But we did have our requests from Russia with the request of relocation increased. Basically, we usually have about like 30 to 50 a month. And now we have about 100 since, maybe even more. Because I mean, the time I checked, it was a couple of days ago. So because I'm not the main case manager, I do help with cases sometimes, but the more complicated ones. So it's just a lot of work. And people, I think the thing is, I just think that every queer person now in Russia, they all need free therapists because it is psychologically very scary and people are panicking. And I mean, we're trying, every queer organization in Russia, we are trying to calm people down as well. But it is really hard. And I know that it sounds like, yes, I will get a therapist, but it's not getting me out of the country. I personally think that because immigration is such a hard thing to do, even if you're not asking for asylum, because I'm, for example, I live in England and I'm obviously, it is a huge privilege, but my visa expires in a year and a half. I'm panicking every day because of this. And I am not even applying for, I mean, probably I will, who knows. But in general, I think that you need to be very cold-headed when you are considering immigration and going through this. This is why I personally think that it is important to not come to this from a place of panic, even though it's really hard to not do this.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And then a therapist could kind of support you in the process, either you decide to migrate somewhere or not, right? Yeah. But I can imagine it's quite difficult to find therapists that are either free and also providing support.
Yeah, we do. We do have a couple of organizations that are friend, like queer friendly organizations that offer psychological help, but usually they have limited sessions. Mm-hmm. So it could be 3, 5, or 10 max. So it is a problem. And I'm always, I mean, it's really sad that there are not a lot of therapists who can offer at least, for example, evaluate a person and based on that say, okay, I think this amount of session would be good for you. But on the other hand, this is again a question of lacking the money, because in the perfect world, probably organizations that do this will have grants and actually will pay their therapists. So yeah, it's all about the money again.
Would you, because you also differentiated a bit, of course, there are different types of cases. Like you said, you are dealing more with the more complicated cases. And you also said like some people might go under this cover of white and straight, so they are not that threatened yet somehow. Could you explain or refer to how present in general the LGBTQ plus community is in the countries you are active in?
You mean how present is, like, if it's loud and active?
How visible, yes.
So, I mean, obviously a white and straight passing person who is an activist, that's another story. But I'm just talking about people who, there are people who obviously live a pretty low-key life. But I think I might be biased because I work in the sector. And of course, I know a lot. There are, I think in most cities that are relatively big, there will be a community center or some kind of community where people would gather together and, you know, just drink and watch some queer movies at least. So there, it is definitely present, but now it's just hard because they're trying to erase people who actually the communities. Because for example, I know someone who has a physical place, like actually a house or a building. I don't know. I've never been there. I just know him from a conference. But in St. Petersburg, where they hold a lot of different meetings, they have psychological meetings, like circles and groups together. They cook dinners together and gather together for, I don't know, special occasions. They have game nights and everything. And it actually sounds amazing, but I don't know if they will be able to. Maybe they will pretend and like change their name and pretend to be a place for everyone, and but which is also scary because you don't know who will come. And yeah, and I mean, the scariest thing, I think, because when you ask how it will affect our work, most of the people from our organization are not in Russia, and have never been there, because it's an international team. And even though I would say about a half of us hold Russian passports, when it even started, they were not in Russia. So I think the people who suffer the most are the organizations that work inside, especially things like shelters or lawyers as well, because there are organizations that help people who are convicted for LGBT propaganda, anything queer related, basically. And now they are being at risk, because defending a queer person when it's extremism is and the lawyer is not safe either. So it's really hard
on a lot of dimensions, I guess. Would you, or could you say, like, besides the new legal frame, or like even like the pre-existing legal frame, are there also differences or in the perception within the society?
It's actually funny, because I have a couple of I have a friend group of basically queer people, and some of them we gather online pretty often, and some of them are in Russia, either to people who are Georgian, and one of them is gay, the other one is non-binary, another trans woman from Russia, and a non-binary person from Ukraine who's now in Poland. I don't know why I'm giving you so much information about them, but basically yesterday we watched a video from a Russian channel which is propagandist now, and it is a talk show kind of with politicians and stuff from 2013. I think it was the year then the first gay propaganda law came, and everyone there was talking about how it doesn't make any sense. Why does the government care about gays when they're stealing money and stuff? And it was on TV. I mean, I was shocked when I saw this, because I forgot that it existed. And then there was in the audience, they did like voting. What bothers you the most? And there were basically three answers: queer people, the government and corruption, and like something like people who drink and stink, something like this. Basically 4% said that it's queer people. Yeah. I mean, obviously this is just an audience on the TV, but it was a federal channel sponsored by the government, and people who were there, I mean, the discussion was completely different, because everyone was like, this is nonsense. And they were like, even though people in Russia probably are not gay friendly, they still don't think it's okay to forbid being queer. So now the picture is completely different. So obviously, because we work with people in Russia and we do know people who are queer and in Russia as friends, most of them are saying that the level of just usual queer phobia, then people shout slurs to you, it's just a common thing. And as well, like I remember in 2013 as well, maybe, or 2014, something like this, mm-hmm. I did with a couple of friends kind of a performance when we were standing in front of the, in Kremlin, there's this cathedral, St. Basil, and we had a picture with a rainbow flag. So we went there and we were taking pictures, and there was a police nearby, didn't say anything. Someone obviously was shouting slurs to us, but I probably would be in jail for 15 or 12 years now for this. So, and this is mind blowing. And the way people changed it's crazy. And sometimes I remember recently someone asked in a conference or something, do you think that homophobia and queerphobia goes like from the top, like from the government, or is it from the people? I personally think that it's both, but now it's encouraged by the government. So, for example, I'm sure that, and I mean, not sure, I know that in the UK, there are quite a lot of people who are queerphobic or specifically transphobic, but which probably will change for the worse because of the government here in the UK. But now, at least in London, this is like, it's bad manners if you're really, or you can lose your job, for example, if you work in a company that is not, I don't know, very conservative. So, and in Russia, it's great. Like, yes, let's hate gays. So they are literally saying to all the people who want to, I don't know, offend people, shout slurs at them, or even do some physical harm, like, yes, nothing will happen to you. Do this. So.
Mm-hmm. So it's more like the societal manner, as you said, right? If it's supported or not, or if it's a bad manner. Would you say the atmosphere also changed for people of color in Russia? Or because, like, besides also intersecting domains?
For sure. It did change because this is why when Cruz Street started, I thought, okay, so Russia is starting a war. When a war, I mean, obviously the war started years ago in 2014, but like started the war escalation. And usually the wars happen, countries become more conservative and the level of nationalism arises. Obviously, especially in Russia, because in Ukraine, I think, from what I heard from people of color there, there are quite a lot of problems, but it's mostly, it is racism, but it had happened before. And now it's more from the government side on how to cross the border. The fact that the European countries are not letting people in, it's a bit different. In Russia, it's really, I think they actually now want to erase other nationalities. Because they're saying we are in Russia, there are two different things. That means like Russian и россиянин. Русский means a Slavic person who is from Russia. Россиянин is like an umbrella term for everyone who holds a Russian passport. Mm-hmm. So now they want to ban the second one and say that everyone is Russian as in Slavic, which doesn't make any sense because there are a lot of people who are not Slavic. And especially there are indigenous people, there are people like me of African descent, of Asian descent. I know quite a lot of Koreans, Russian Koreans, for example, and many other people. So as well as just in the streets, people are feeling much more unsafe. There has been, we don't have any statistics, but if we're talking about the news and everything, there has been much more hate crimes towards immigrants or just anyone who is not Slavic. And to me, I think what I felt myself is the last time I was in Russia, it was summer 2022. I was there for 6 days. I was very scared, but I had to help my family. And I remember me and my wife, even when we stepped on the plane to Moscow, everyone was staring at us because we're Black. Mm-hmm. It happened before when we lived in Russia, but it was not to that level. So people were like screaming Ku Klux Klan at us and stuff like this, basically on the street. And this is Moscow, which is like considered to be more cosmopolitan for basically anyone who is different. And it, in general, I don't know, I'm actually, in terms of people of color, I am scared for this because with mobilization statistics, again, I'm sure you probably talked to Denhaya about this, that they are sending people to war who are not Slavic and from non-Slavic regions. Disproportionately, the numbers are very high compared to the Slavic regions. And Russia now is also, which scares me personally, is trying to build connections with Africa, trying to be this like big brother who saves them from the West. And now to quite a lot of people I talk to here in the UK from Africa. It's hard, I mean, not to all of them, but to some of them. They think that Russia is like a good thing because they're saving them from the West, but they don't quite, because they don't know a lot about what's happening in Russia because it's far away and stuff. They don't understand that Russia will probably do worse things to them, even though it's not possible, it seems. But And even the fact that recently there was a student from Gabon who was stabbed to death in Yekaterinburg, which is, I think, the third or the fourth biggest city in Russia. And it was definitely motivated by racism, and some skinhead groups were fundraising for a lawyer for the guy who stabbed him. Mm-hmm. And I see in the news, unfortunately, also there are quite a lot of insensitive people who think that they should send me this. I see it anyway, but I just think it's to send that someone who has the same skin color as you has been murdered or attacked, take a look. So, I mean, but in general, I think, yeah, hate crimes are definitely on the rise. And even the way they talk about things, if an immigrant does something, obviously they will say he's an immigrant in the news. This is because he's an immigrant, even though it takes statistics. Immigrants commit about 3% of all crimes in Russia. So, no comment on that. So
I think it's unfortunately that the public and the political atmosphere in this sense is changing in a lot of places, unfortunately. And then statistics, of course, I mean, if you have statistics that prove that they commit way less crimes, that's good, but mostly also some statistics you can't trust them sometimes, because which cases are recorded and which are not, for example.
Yeah, that's true. But this is why we don't have any statistics in Russia.
Yes.
It's just crazy. There is no statistics on anything about, for example, hate crimes to queer people, to people of color, because they are usually not recorded that way. Domestic violence, just why have them? So,
yeah. Could you explain or refer a bit how's the situation in, for example, for LGBTQ plus people seeking for asylum or for refugee in other countries?
Well, I keep saying that everything is going far right at the moment. Well, obviously there are some countries that are not, like Spain. I probably should have looked up Portugal as well, because I actually don't know how you're doing there. But in general, most countries are becoming more and more right, which is unfortunate, but it's important to keep it in mind, because it is not easy to get asylum if you're a queer person from Russia. On the other hand, from what I see, I think it is a little easier. Well, actually, it's much easier to get asylum if you're queer from Russia comparing to most countries with queerphobic laws, especially in the global south, even though their laws are mostly harsher. Because for now, at least, for example, same-sex sex is not forbidden in Russia and stuff like this. But it is important to understand that, as Suella Braverman, the person who ran, I don't know, immigration here in the UK, but she doesn't anymore, said, if you are gay, it's not enough to get asylum. And this crazy to say, then you are working with immigrants, especially when you have so many immigrants from, again, global south. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it is true. So you have to have a case. And I know that it's a lot of people, they want to choose a country based on where they want to live, which makes sense because you are going to live there. But you have to also keep in mind how strong is your asylum case. Because, for example, I obviously wouldn't name the countries, because they will probably say, oh, she thinks that it's easy to get asylum in our country. We'll never give, I mean, not probably, but especially I can highlight the countries where it's really hard and a lot of people want to go there, Scandinavian countries. Some time ago, maybe a year ago, a person who is from Chechnya, where there are underground gay prisons, where they torture people for years and pretend that they are dead, like their death certificates, or they're missing and they torture them for years. There was one person who was in that prison and who managed to escape, and who, I don't remember, I think it was Sweden or Norway, they declined his asylum. Yeah, and again, we had a person who worked with us, and he applied for asylum in Iceland years ago. He lived there for 3 or 4 years. There were not enough proofs that he was gay, which I would not even comment on. And he decided to leave Iceland. So, and again, I'm sorry, it's probably a very sad podcast, but in general, this is why I think that if you want to claim asylum, it means, especially, or even immigrate in a more, like, as a student, as a worker, or whatever, this is a really hard process. For example, again, recently in the Netherlands, which I think has this, I don't know, aura of the perfect country to ask for asylum for queer people, we had a trans girl who couldn't get her hormone therapy for 2 years, and she had such strong gender dysphoria that she committed suicide while waiting for it. So, and again, in the Netherlands, far-right stuff is happening now. So it's really scary, but I still think there is a way to get asylum. You just have to prepare it that it will take a long way, and to have a plan, what happens if my asylum will be declined, so that they will not deport you back to Russia, for example, or Belarus. But in my, actually, from what I see, I don't have a lot of people, at least we work with, who applied for asylum, who were declined the asylum. But I think it is because, as well, this is why, I mean, obviously, they are doing most of the work. We are actually trying to build our organization in a way that we can be your companion in this, but we're not doing things for you. So we're working together, and we can just guide you a little bit. But I think because people talked to us and we said, all right, so we see your case, we think that you should there, these are the countries that most likely will accept your asylum. For example, we didn't have, as of yet, anyone whose asylum was declined. But also, it's important to state that we only exist for a bit less than 2 years, and some of them are still waiting for decisions. So it doesn't mean that it's perfect. Probably someone will still, but hopefully not. So yeah.
I think it's a process, and overall, it's a good quote, and it is insane. But another important aim of you is, like, besides supporting people for asylum or giving them support somehow, an important aim from QueerSwit is also digital activism, right?
Yeah.
And kind of the creation and dissemination of information. Earlier this year, we had a podcast with a person that is researching on digital activism and LGBTQ rights in Iran. And she quoted that without social networks, there wouldn't have been a conversation. Could I ask you on your opinion, also in your area, you're doing the activism?
Actually, this is so funny that I completely forgot to mention that, because we do a lot of digital activism, and also we do events in many different countries, in the West mostly. But yeah, we do quite a lot of, we try to raise awareness. And I think this is also a very important part, because now at least there is a conversation in the countries that we work with, which is, for now, we say there's ECCA countries, which is, EECA. I don't know why. Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And obviously in Central Asia, because people from Central Asia are Asian themselves, they were actually our biggest supporters, I must say, from the beginning, which was a surprise for me, because I never had any support from anyone who is not of the same descent and stuff. But yeah, and I think now there is a lot of discussion about the intersection of being queer and being not white or not from a racialized community. And I think it really, we were definitely one of the first ones, and now a lot of people are talking about it in the region. So it's really great. And I am very happy to see this. But also the other thing that we do, which is also very important, is that we talk, because our social networks, we have it in Russian and Ukrainian and in English. And obviously it's like three very different audiences. Mm-hmm. So for example, in Ukrainian, we never ask for donations. So we never fundraise. Like, for example, if we have a fundraising post, we'd never post it in Ukrainian because we don't want to take money from Ukrainians. We want to give them money. But again, the level, obviously, both people from who speak Ukrainian and who speak Russian, they understand the context much more than people who are interested but are not from the region. So there we do more educational posts, more in-depth posts. And I think from what I've seen with the response, there are quite a lot of people that didn't know about it that are interested. And it really helps, because now we have a much bigger network of activists, of people who want to talk about this, to open this conversation. And for example, this weekend, I'm going on an event where I'm going to be there as a speaker, and also there's going to be another queer black person who is from Africa originally, but she was in Ukraine when the war escalated and she ran away. And I think I wouldn't be able to find her if we wouldn't do the digital activism. So it's really amazing.
Yeah, can imagine. Also, it's an important channel of kind of educating and informing, right?
Yeah, of course. This is why I said that a lot of people just don't know a lot of stuff about what's going on. For example, I remember talking to people here in the UK, and they didn't even know that Russia has its own Asians, mm-hmm. which what I'm trying to say is like indigenous Asian nations that historically started in current Russia's territory. They didn't know that. So it really does spreading information and talking about this. There is a lot of education in this. And in general, I'm very happy to know that now there are more people that know that this problem exists and that this context exists in general. Actually, I am still surprised that it's such, and this territory is literally uncharted. And 2023, and this is just very strange to me, to be honest.
Yep, it is. In general, when you think about how things developed, also like in the positive changes, because like, of course, you said the aim would be that there is no threat and people get asylum or that they get supported. What is, in your opinion, a way to get there, to also live in a world without transphobia, homophobia, or racism, or other forms of discrimination?
Sorry, you mean like in for the world, or you mean that when a person gets asylum, how does it impact?
No, I can restate a bit. In your opinion, what are the next steps to approach these goals, especially in Russia and in the Ukraine, or also in Europe in general?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you ask for asylum, I don't think there is a not racist and not queerphobic country in the world, but it's just getting to a safer country, I think. But in general, this is a very hard question, because now, even though it is very, well, it's not very easy, but the steps to do is easy. It's to educate people to stop being homophobic, queerphobic, transphobic, and anti-racist. I mean, what I'm trying to say by to stop, at least do not get these people to the government. Stop supporting conservatives for your own good, as in, I don't know, your business will pay more taxes. Yes, your business will pay more taxes, but the world will be a better place. So if you have a business, you're already doing well. So yeah. But what I'm trying to say is, I think there needs to be a lot of education, a lot of awareness, and I think honestly there is a lot of ignorance in there, because I don't think that people, for example, who hate immigrants know anything about immigrants except for what they saw someone one day and they didn't like their behavior, and then they read the news and thought that it's all immigrants' fault. No, if you're miserable, if something happened in your life, definitely it's not the immigrants' fault and it's not the queer people's fault. So even if, I don't know, your wife left you for a girl, it is not the queer's fault. She just couldn't come out, or maybe she thought that she was straight. But I mean, what I'm trying to say is that it's not that hard when you think about it, but I don't think it's going to happen, because we just need to raise awareness and we need to educate people, and we don't need to let ignorant people rule the countries. But I also don't think that it's possible. This is why sometimes people ask me, if you have this pessimistic kind of view for the future, why are you still doing this? And I think it's because I don't have the goal to change any country, because I don't, I'm that big. But my goal is to give some people just like a bit of guidance on how to probably have a better life than they had before. And I don't have any, I don't know, I understand that obviously if now things are going right in politics wise, at some point it will go back to the left, but I don't know when it will happen, and the left is going to happen. So yeah, but it feels like a lot of work that a lot of activists have done and like opened the doors for us, the activists that we are now, they kind of destroyed a lot of their work, and we have to do it again. Obviously, it's going to be easier because there were other people before us. But this is how I also see my work, that I don't think that I will achieve a lot on a government level or something. But probably I will open doors for other Black queer activists from the region who will succeed more than I will. I don't know. But obviously, if it happens, that's cool. But I just think I don't have, not that I'm not ambitious, it's just I don't want to be disappointed. And I think it's important to keep your head in the reality. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's also, you never know in the end. And if you start small, sometimes you start to reach bigger goals, because it just happens more naturally.
Yeah.
Wrapping up a bit, maybe what can be the contributions of everyone?
I think it depends, but at least just do your research, maybe talk about it. Even I think that sharing Instagram posts is not nothing, to be honest, because I read what my friends share, and especially if it's political and I'm interested in it, or I don't know nothing about it. But I think sharing is good. If you can have, like, if you want to know something more and do like an in-depth research, maybe watch something about anything in the world, which is, yeah, I mean, because there are a lot, obviously I want to say that I would be happy if people would know more about the intersection of queerness and race in Russia, in Ukraine, in Belarus, in Kazakhstan, basically in the region I work at. But in general, if you can donate, please do. But also, I always say, so who are the people who donate to us? It's the community. And it's really, but please think about yourself first, because I always say this, that you have to be in a better place to help someone. And I think this is what the thing that I've really learned from working and overworking as well. This is not how it should be done. But also, what I would suggest, if you want to volunteer, please do. But in general, sharing information is already very important, and just educating yourself, because even when you educate yourself and then you talk to someone in the kitchen, it's already activism.
Thank you very much. For me, I covered all my questions. Is there anything you would like to leave or to address?
I mean, I would just say that if someone hears this and thinks that they want to do something with us or collaborate in a way, please message us. I think you will have all our social networks. But in general, I think I just want to say that I really hope that things will work out in a way, at least for the people who come to us. And I mean, obviously for everyone, but that's what I can control. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important to do just something. If you can do just something to help someone out, that's great. And another thing that I would add is, please don't blame yourself for not doing enough, because if you're doing something, you're already doing more than most of the people. So yeah, and it doesn't help anyone. I've been there. Yeah, I'm probably now doing too much. So it's also not good. So yeah.
Should somehow also finding the balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you start blaming yourself and not doing something, you will for sure end up in this resonating state of just, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Intersectionality Lab. If some terms or topics made you curious, check out our website. Maybe some of the resources will keep your thoughts rolling. Meet us where the lines cross. We are a non-profit research center working on human rights, gender equality, and active citizenship. And this podcast was created with the support of our team.